Are you prepared to bug out? Infidel Body Armor and an Army Ranger have produced a high-speed DVD and book to show you how to drive in combat, patrol, and how to survive in combat. Skills you'll need when it hits the fan. Go to DrivenDVD.com. DrivenDVD.com.
Herbs have been used by people since the dawn of time. When Rockefeller introduced allopathic medicine, many herbal remedies fell by the wayside as people put their faith in prescription pills and the world just gets sicker. Here at Heathen Herbs, we look to the past and to nature for answers. We offer tinctures, magnesium skin cream, lip balm, tooth powder, colloidal silver throat spray, and more. Check us out at heathenherbs.com.
We are the American Freedom Party. This is the most urgent time in the history of Western civilization. In the year 1900, white people of European descent comprised 35% of the world population. Today it is less than 9% and falling fast. Europe is being overrun with Middle Eastern immigrants, and America's founding stock is rapidly being replaced with third world peoples from around the globe. For the last 50 years, every influential institution in this nation, our schools and universities, our media, our churches and our employers have promoted policies and principles that teach whites to be ashamed of their great heritage and birthright. We, who in the 1950s, the 1960s, and 1970s were the world's dominant force, are now so afraid of being called racist that we were quailing towards irrelevance and extinction. Join the American Freedom Party today. Reach us at theamericanfreedomparty.us or call us at 701-317-5317. Paid for by the American Freedom Party.
You've made a serious investment in protecting yourself and your family. You've purchased the gun, the ammunition, the training, and even secured a license to carry in your state. You know the Constitution and don't believe you should have to pay for a right that you already have, as written in the Second Amendment, but you are law-abiding. Now you are considering the legal defense options you should have if you ever have to use a firearm. Self-Defense Fund is a comprehensive litigation membership backing you on appeals, legal expenses, court costs, and more. Up to $1 million per incident and unlimited attorney costs per member. Discover selfdefensefund.com for yourself. Any weapon, any state, any time.
You're listening to Resolution Radio. ResolutionRDO.com.
Welcome to American Dissident Voices. I'm Kevin Alfred Strom. To celebrate the life's work of National Alliance founder William Pierce, we will be broadcasting Vanessa Neubauer's audio version of the first book ever published by Dr. Pierce, his translation of Dietrich Eckart's Bolshevism from Moses to Lenin, a conversation between the author and the soon-to-be German leader Adolf Hitler. The book's insights were, I think, fundamental to William Pierce's awakening to a full understanding of this world. Let's continue with part three of this extraordinary book. When we left off last week, we were discussing the Jewish influence on Christianity, from the earliest times to the present, from the vile Old Testament to Saul, who became Paul, to Martin Luther's unwitting betrayal of his own people, which he recognized too late. And now I give you Vanessa Neubauer.
In the case of the struggling young Christianity, for example, the Jews, quick as a flash, began hanging onto its coattails. Consider Paul, properly called Shaul, who was a rabbinical student. That Shaul first chose the Roman-sounding name Saulus and then had himself renamed Paulus gives cause for thought. Still more, the fact that, in the beginning, he persecuted the fledgling Christian community with first-rate ferocity. I don't know, mass murderers who later become saints. Is that not too much of a marvel? Indeed, the Jew, Weininger, supposed that Christ had also originally been a criminal. But, my God, a Jew could say that 100 times, and it still need not be true on that account. As a Jew, Paul certainly knew that of all the peoples of the world, the Jews, first and foremost, needed their souls saved. Go not to the Gentiles, but go rather to the lost sheep of the house of Israel, demanded Christ. Paul ignored it. He went to the Greeks and the Romans and brought them his Christianity. A Christianity with which the Roman Empire became unhinged. All men are equal. Brotherhood. Pacifism. No more privileges. And the Jew triumphed. I always think, I spun the thread further, of the admirable Herr Levin in the Berliner Lokal Anzeiger. He suddenly burst out one day, as if in rapture. Only a Jew could have done that. Could have, with Paul's impudence, put himself in the middle of the capital and there expounded a doctrine which must bring about the utter ruin of the Roman Empire. That's what the man said, word for word. I still remember it perfectly. It certainly hits the nail on the head, he rejoined. It may be a long time yet before Christianity recovers from Paul. Oh, what gullible souls we are! A Jew murders hundreds of Christians. Suddenly he notices that the rest only become even more zealous. The well-known light dawns on him. He pretends to be converted, throws himself into the great pose, and behold! Even though he deviates in nearly all his doctrines from the other apostles, we listen devoutly to his sermons. The simple teachings of the Master, which the most childlike mind might comprehend, we must have explained to us by a Hebrew. The Jew, I replied, certainly must be tempted to say, why are you so stupid that you let everyone make fools of you? And there are many charmers and wizards who, on account of his extraordinary cunning, or spirituality, as they call it, look upon him with timid admiration. If it depended on mere possessions, he returned, they would be justified. Someone named Goldstein once boasted that the Jews administer the spiritual property of the German people. A pity that he didn't add how they administer it. Well, let us be thankful that there will always be men who, for example, will read Goethe through the eyes of Goethe and not through the slimy spectacles of Goldstein. They may not be professors, but perhaps vagabonds of a sort. A breed, anyway, which will not become extinct and through which the original Goethe will be safely preserved. The Jews can then quietly administer the new Goethe. It will not be begrudged them. Suppose, however, I interjected anxiously, the vagabonds also listen credulously to them and fall into the trap? It lies in the nature of the vagabond, he laughed, to have a heart so full that it matters not how his head happens to be persuaded. It will always be his heart that determines the outcome. They feel intuitively that which the clever, despite their understanding, are not able to see. And they preserve it. One may deceive their heads, but not even they have authority over their spirits. 6. And, you see, he pounded on the table, they alone are to be thanked that at least part of our Christian heritage, as well as our other cultural legacy, has survived administration by the Jews. Where are they? Where were they? Among high and low. Among the kings and the soldiers, among the popes and the mendicant friars, among the learned and the illiterate, everywhere. but not among the nothing but rich, but not among the nothing but clever, but not among the greedy and the insatiable, but not among the purple folk. Here, the Jew is at home. Whatever appears here in the way of spiritual possessions, he matter-of-factly administers. It is his own, just as everything was transformed into gold for King Midas. Every deep and meaningful word is turned into filth at his touch. But for the others, for the vagabonds of the spirit I threw to him, everything remains as of old. He nodded. There have been popes of Jewish blood. Also, there has seldom or never been a shortage of other dignitaries of the same descent in the church. Was that which they stood for Catholicism? No, it was Judaism. Let's take just one thing. The selling of indulgences. The very essence of the Jewish spirit. We are both Catholics, but dare we not say that? Are we really supposed to believe that there has never been anything in the church with which one can find fault? Just because we are Catholics, we say it. That has nothing to do with Catholicism. We know that Catholicism would have remained intact even if half the hierarchy had consisted of Jews. A number of sincere men always held it high, though often only secretly, many times even against the Pope. Sometimes there were many such men, sometimes few. The investigation of the Jew and his activities should have been the alpha and the omega of our historians. Instead, they investigate the bowel movements of the past. Karl the Great favored the Jews at every turn. It seems to me that his slaughter of the 4,500 Saxons at Verden, the best German blood, and his Jewish advisors had something to do with one another. The notorious insanity of the Crusades bled the German people of 6 million men. Finally, the Hohenstaufen, Friedrich II, succeeded through mere negotiation without striking a blow in securing the Holy Land for Christendom. What did the Curia do? Full of hatred, they hurled the ban of excommunication on Friedrich and refused to recognize his treaty with the Sultan, thus neutralizing his great success. It seems that, to those pulling the strings, the incidental bloodletting was more important than the avowed objective of the Crusades. At last came the Children's Crusade. Tens of thousands of children sent against the victorious Turkish army, all to be destroyed. I can't believe that the idea for that absurdity originated in a non-Jewish mind. I am always reminded of the murder of the children of Bethlehem and the slaughter of the Egyptian firstborn. I would give anything for a photograph of the priest who preached that crusade and his flunkies. Giordano Bruno called the Jews such a pestilential, leprous, and publicly dangerous race that they deserve to be rooted out and destroyed even before their birth. This genial philosopher was burned at the stake. For his heresy? Opponents of the church were swarming in Italy during his time, yet he, the most impartial of them, was seized. Well, how about now? I interrupted him. In Russia, one Catholic priest after another is tortured to death by the Jewish beast. Hundreds have already been liquidated. The church is taking its last gasp. But Rome cannot bring herself to call the child by its real name. Many times she has made a small start in that direction, but only to be immediately squelched. Catholicism wants to speak. Jewry paralyzes its tongue. Rome, he replied, will pull herself together, but only if we pull ourselves together first. And one day it can be said that the church is whole again. Since those who are responsible for the trouble will have been discovered, I cried. Since the disguised Hebrew, together with his cuckoo eggs, will have been thrown out of the Christian community. He has not only set the Egyptians, but also the Christians against one another, so that they shall fight every one against his brother and every one against his neighbor. And he is still at this game. He works from the outside, carefully building his pitfalls and making his destructive influence felt in the press. But he also works from the inside, where he is even more dangerous, in the mask of the Christian minister. The Christian confessions swarm with Jewish and half-Jewish clergymen, the Protestant denominations even more so than the Catholic. They already feel so sure of victory in the Protestant churches that in Dresden, a certain Pastor Wolfisch had the impudence to announce publicly, "I am a Jew and will remain one." Yes, now that I have learned the Christian beliefs, I have become more than ever a true Israelite. And in Hamburg, a preacher named Schwalb said, "I consider myself a genuine Jew and have always considered myself thus." Where that sort of thing is possible, Christianity might as well let itself be buried. Luther's spirit seems to be completely played out among our Protestants. On the question of all questions, the Jewish question, they either hush him completely or try to tone him down. One of the most well-meaning among their theologians, Professor Walter, calls Luther's attitude toward the Jews, quote, "so offensive that it must arouse not only confused astonishment among Christians, but also great indignation among Jews," end quote. Those Christians with a confused astonishment wouldn't have found themselves in that state if they had not previously let themselves be confused by the Jews. And as for the great indignation of the Hebrews, we are not grieved a bit. Where, by the way, has that indignation been apparent? So far, Israel has been quiet as a mouse about it. They have always praised Luther greatly as the enemy of Rome. Heine began a ceremonious hymn of joy to the reformer with the words, "Luther, you dear man." "He had good reason," he jeered. "All Jews have good reason to celebrate Luther and to ignore his anti-Semitism. Without intending to do so, he paved the way for them. And how? The more they extol his authority, the less the world notices his error. That he later cursed them as a pestilence is indeed bitter to them, but how many people are even aware of his condemnation of the Jews?" "The Jew Goldman," I put in, "stated their reason plainly enough. Quote, Luther has again brought the Old Testament to honor," end quote. "Instead of to dishonor," was the reply. His translation to the German language might have been of some use. As it is, it has grievously damaged the German power of discernment. Lord in heaven, what a halo now surrounds Satan's Bible. Luther's poetry sparkles so that even the incest of Lot's daughters has been given a religious shimmer. Jehovah's command to be fruitful and multiply had to be obeyed only by these two pious maidens, at any price. Schopenhauer expressed a similar opinion, I confirmed. He said that, if one wants to understand the Old Testament, one must read it in the Greek version. There it has an entirely different tone, an entirely different color, with no presentiment of Christianity. Contrasted with the Greek, Luther's translation seems pious. Also, quote, "often erroneous, indeed, sometimes intentionally, and delivered throughout in a churchly edifying tone," end quote. Luther has permitted himself changes, quote, "which one could call forgeries," end quote, and so on. Not Luther. He raised his finger. The rabbis who helped him with the entire translation introduced changes and forgeries. Hebrew is a difficult language. Luther translated a certain word, for example, as racial kinsman. But then the rabbi came in and said that the word means neighbor. And so we have the translation. Love thy neighbor as thyself. Rather than, as it should be, love thy racial kinsman as thyself. A small piece of cunning, but it served its purpose of giving the Jews the aspect of real humanitarians. Yes, even Luther was taken in by the chosen people, I replied. He looked upon the Old Testament as divine revelation. He approached the book with infatuation, convinced that it could contain nothing but sheer preciousness. Then he began wading into the vile thing. After a few steps, he blinked his eyes, bewildered. He was stunned. That just couldn't be so. It must have some other meaning. And so, with perfectly honest intentions, he read between the lines what simply wasn't there. Everywhere, he managed to see allusions to Christ, although nothing could be farther from the Jews' actual thoughts on the matter. Their Messiah is no lamb's tail, Heine jeered at Christ, no scorner of earthly existence. On the contrary, their Messiah is a brutal dog who will conquer the earth for his Jews. He is the prince of this world. Page after page, it says, quote, ye shall eat the riches of the Gentiles, and in their glory shall ye boast yourselves, end quote. Or, quote, ask of me, and I shall give thee the heathen for thine inheritance, and the uttermost parts of the earth for thy possession, end quote. One of these is a statement of a divinely inspired prophet, the other a deeply spiritual psalm. Credulously, Luther viewed everything in a rosy light. This became easier for him when, in the middle of the great morass, he came to passages like, quote, ye will have no permanent existence among the nations, and the soles of thy feet shall find no rest, end quote. And, quote, ye will be an abomination among all peoples, end quote. Compassion seized him. The Jews, he thought to himself, have become untrue to their godly doctrine, but they will again find their way home to it. It never occurred to him that these direly threatening sermons served only the purpose of holding the Jews to their course. On the other hand, many passages of apparently lofty stamp have quite a different purpose. Namely, they serve as a protective cover. He later recognized this Jewish tactic, but only in the Living Hebrews, not in their Bible. The Jews desire to make all their affairs ambiguous, so that nothing about them is really certain, he said. If one belabors them for an especially low-minded passage, they can indignantly point at one which is dripping with loving kindness. Heine, for example, writes an utterly vulgar poem about Germany. 5 minutes later, he is praising the dear homeland to the skies. A matter of changing mood? Oh, dear God, I suppose that we are to believe that an old street whore often finds herself in the mood to sing the Ave Maria, or that a basically honest fellow is often in the mood to steal. What nonsense! No, you are right, he said. The Jew often plays the role of a benefactor only in order to accomplish his destructive aims without notice. It's always been that way. This ambiguity, I completed, one finds even in Spinoza. One can hardly imagine a bolder, more outspoken worldview than his. But his ethics would horrify a pig. "In all things, seek that which is advantageous," is the quintessence of his moral philosophy, the genuine Jewish viewpoint. "It is the most terrible tragedy," he said sadly, "that Luther bears the responsibility for such a dire development, the consequence of deeds committed in perfect innocence, that today all civilization is in danger of running aground on it. The greatest German, the unsuspecting cause of the German collapse. Luther, the mighty opponent of the Jews, the one who most disastrously paved the way for them. Incomprehensible, I tell you, incomprehensible. To happen too late by a paltry 10 or 20 years. To first become awake to the Jews shortly before his death, when everything had already been determined. Previously, body and soul for the traitors. Then the Hebrews had still been cousins and brothers of our Lord to him, while we Christians were only brother-in-law and strangers. Wringing his hands, he entreated the populace to associate with them in a decent and proper manner. To him they were exalted above the apostles. The late Erzberger couldn't have carried on more absurdly. Only not for an instant as sincerely, I stopped him. If Luther had been a contemporary of Erzberger, he wouldn't have had to find out about the purpose of the Jewish hush money first, in order to see through Judaism. As early as his student days, he would have promptly leaped with both feet into the battle against the devil's brood. My God, he immediately resumed, one cannot blame him. A lot has happened in the last 400 years. But there is one thing to remember. Popular instinct was more alert then than nowadays. All along the line, mistrust of the Jews was quite firm. Luther was a man of the people, the son of simple folk. His predilection of many years toward the Jews is a bit misleading. One must take into account a certain naivete, a lack of worldliness, the result of his stay in the cloister. The same rule seems to have applied here as elsewhere. Too much studying ruined his vision. Nevertheless, Luther was a great man, a giant. With a shock which pierced the twilight, he saw the Jews as we have only begun to see them today. But, unfortunately, too late. And even then, not there, where he had done the most damage. In Christianity. Oh, had he only seen them there. Had he only seen them in his youth. Then he would not have attacked Catholicism, but rather the Jews behind it. Instead of a wholesale condemnation of the church, he would have let his whole passionate impetus fall on the true villains. Instead of glorifying the Old Testament, he would have branded it as the arsenal of the Antichrist. And the Jew. The Jew would have stood there in his abominable nakedness as an eternal warning. He would have been obliged to get out of the church, out of society, out of the halls of the princes, out of the castles of the knights, and the houses of the citizens. For Luther had the strength and the courage, and the overpowering will. It would never have come to the splitting of the church, or to the war which, in accordance with the wishes of the Hebrews, spilled Aryan blood in torrents for 30 long years.
You've just heard part 3 of Dr. William Pierce's translation of Dietrich Eckart's Bolshevism from Moses to Lenin, read by Vanessa Neubauer. We'll conclude our series based on this important, insightful work next week, right here on American Dissident Voices.
You're listening to Resolution Radio, Radio, Radio. ResolutionRDO.com.
My brothers, my sisters, I bring you a message of solidarity, a call to action, and a demand for adherence to duty of an Aryan resurgence and ultimately total Aryan victory. We have broken the chains of Jewish thought. We know not the meaning of the word mine, it is ours. Our race, the totality of our people. 10 hearts, one beat. 100 hearts, one beat. 10,000 hearts, one beat. We are born to fight and to die and to continue the flow. The flow of our people. Onward we will go, onward to the stars, high above the mud of yellow, black, and brown. So kinsmen, duty calls. The future is now. If months from now you have not yet fully committed yourself to the alliance, then you have in effect not only betrayed your race, you have betrayed yourself. So stand up like men and drive the enemy into the sea. Stand up like men and swear a sacred oath upon the green graves of our sires that you will reclaim what our forefathers discovered, explored, conquered, settled, built, and died for. Stand up like men and reclaim our soil. Kinsmen, arise. Look towards the stars and proclaim our destiny. Defeat never, victory forever.
Water is the single most important thing your body needs, so you want to be sure it's the best for you and your family. Since 2005, thousands have depended on Berkey Purified Water. The Berkey guy provides the lowest priced filtration systems in every size. For incredibly delicious water now and in an emergency, get to GoBerkey.com or call 877-886-3653. 877-886-3653. GoBerkey.com.
What would your life be like if you woke up each morning with new vitality, feeling better than you have in years, and you noticed a difference in your sleeping patterns, blood sugar levels, and had a sense of well-being overall? There's something that is changing thousands of people's lives, and you could be one of them. It's called Heart and Body Extract. Sharon Harris, co-creator of Heart and Body Extract, talks about the positive effects of Heart and Body Extract.
What happens with the formula Heart and Body Extract is it's giving the body the necessary vitamins, minerals, amino acids, enzymes, and phytonutrients so the body will heal itself. And yes, the body does have the ability to balance blood pressure, balance cholesterol, clean and unclog the arteries. It can also work on balancing the circulation for diabetics. So the body is an amazing thing. It simply needs some help so it has the tools to heal itself.
Heart and Body Extract gets results. To order your 2-month supply, call now, toll free at 866-295-5305. Order online at hbextract.com.
I believe in race. I'm not ashamed to admit it at all. And that doesn't mean one bit that I'm out to persecute or hurt any man because of his race. He can't help what race he is. We believe that each race has particular geniuses and particular faults. The white race has built white Western civilization, and we think the white race should dominate in that area. National socialism fundamentally is the application of science not only to inanimate objects and animals, but to mankind himself. We believe that the communists, the Marxists, have one fatal error in their doctrine. A place where absolutely there's a hole and there's no explanation for it. They admit evolution. They admit that animals vary by breed and that you can breed better and worse animals. Now, how do they explain how there is a sudden dividing line when you come to one particular animal called man? They have no explanation. Time and again, when I've asked them, they have no explanation. They just say, if it's got two legs and it stands on its hind feet, then it suddenly becomes a special being and there is absolute equality. They're all the same. Man is an animal just like all the rest of the animals. He's more intelligent, but he must obey nature's laws. And that insofar as he is an animal, he must obey the laws that pertain to animals. We say that when the white race has produced such a wonderful thing as Western civilization, we should treasure the people that have produced that and can maintain it. And we should not mix them all up with other kinds of civilizations, whether or not they're good. We should certainly try to preserve it just the way the farmer preserves his better grade of stock. We are also, socially speaking, tribalists. You must live as social beings. You have to live with other people. And this is impossible unless you observe certain fundamental laws of the tribe, the ancient Indian tribe, any kind of tribe of people, even a wolf pack, has got to have certain fundamental things. One of these things is leadership. Not leadership by the most popular, but by the strongest and the best. Any tribe or Indian tribe or any group or family should be led by the best and the strongest. Otherwise, it disintegrates. It's got to have group pride and loyalty. You've got to have selection in the mating process, something that we have almost lost now. We believe that it is of fundamental importance to society that the strongest, cleverest, and the best of the men mate with the best type of women who will make good mothers. And when you destroy that machinery, you get what we have now. We believe that you have got to have an organic society. Now, by an organic society, we mean a society, not a dictatorship, but a society in which the parts of the society cooperate together in different functions and in peace and harmony, just the way your body works. Cancer is the wild, uncontrolled growth of cells at the expense of all the rest of the body, and that's what you have in Washington, D.C. right now. Cancer. We believe in private property and free enterprise. It is impossible, we believe, to have a society in which there is any real work going on unless people can get the reward of their effort. And at the same time, we believe you've got to have social justice. You cannot have people who are exploiting and squeezing little helpless people economically. And this is where I get in trouble with the conservatives, because most of today's conservatives, I've discovered, are reactionaries. They're real anxious to hold on to their money. They don't care how they have to figure it out. They just want those money bags. And they come up with any kind of rationale to keep it. Every national socialist believes in idealism, believes in something that is worth more than his own one single human life. He's willing to die for something. When you're ready to die for something, then you're alive. And until you are ready to die for something, you have no real fanaticism. And just to dinner a little while ago with some of the fellows there, they said, were telling me, well, it's terrible to be a fanatic. Well, did you ever stop and think how this country got here? How all the great inventions ever got there? Any one of you out there that is not a fanatic on something or other, whatever it is you're studying, if you're going to be a doctor, be a fanatical doctor. Otherwise, you'll be nothing. You'll just be an ordinary old chug-chugging guy, and when you die, nobody will notice it. But if you're a fanatic, you'll produce something great. You'll create. Creativity is fanaticism. Every creative genius has had to be a fanatic. Many of them have been burned at the stake. So we are ideological and idealistic fanatics. Just like the communists, by the way. In between the Nazis and the communists is the great mass of non-fanatics. The TV watchers and the comic book readers. I will say this. National socialism is the inevitable end product, logically, of evolution. If you believe in evolution, you've got to be a Nazi if you think about it long enough. You can't help it. But what happens is people short-circuit it. The minute they believe in evolution and scientific breeding until they come to that two-legged animal that stands up on its hind legs, then all the rules are up. We say that's not possible. You either believe in the scientific method and the truth, and you apply it to yourself without egotism, or else you don't believe in the scientific method and you're kidding yourself. Nazis believe in ruthless application of the truth, not only to inanimate matter and animals, but to you animals. People, all of us, are the same insofar as we are animals and must survive and live as animals. And unless we breed ourselves better, we're going to get worse. That's what's happening. I do worship nature in that I'm humble. When I see the mighty, awesome power of nature, and believe me, I've seen some terrific power of nature, the typhoons off Japan during the war, earthquakes. I've been through some tremendous cataclysms on this earth. And compared to them, the atomic bomb is like a firecracker. Nothing. And when you start to think of the enormity of space, our spacemen are just going around at the very bottom levels of space. They're no place yet. There are over 100 million planets where life, just like here, could exist. And in the face of that awesome probability, not possibility, probability, I say it's ridiculous to be egocentric and say we are the center of all things. Everything turns around us. We Nazis are humble. When I look at nature and realize how ignorant and small and feeble and weak and little we are, Nazism is a philosophy of nature, a way of looking at the world. And as I've pointed out, we believe in tribalism. We don't think we're above that. We think that you've got to have pride in your family, pride in your race, pride in your nation. That's not something to laugh at. Patriotism and pride in family and pride in race is something we should be proud of and cultivate, work on, not get rid of. Finally, we believe in morals. We believe in the traditions of goodness, virtue. Now, I told you something about what we are, but I'll do as good as I can in telling you what I think our enemies are. And our enemies, make no mistake about it, are the Marxists. The philosophy of Marxism, I believe, is the enemy of all humanity. It's the reverse of humanity. We say communism itself is the most vicious, anti-social doctrine the world has ever known, and here's why. They completely deny the very basis on which any human order can exist at all. Without humans, or at least without civilized humans, you certainly can't have human order. And the communists say they don't believe in race. They believe in absolute equality. The pygmies, the aborigines of Australia, everybody. Send them, let them all come to Carlton, and they'll all write arias and books. And the cannibals will be producing the music and verses. That's all you have to do is educate them. And this simply is not true. This results in chaos, social chaos, which is what we have now. They don't believe in enterprise. They don't believe that people should work for themselves. They believe that the state should come and tell them what to do. They don't believe in private property. They don't believe that you can keep the fruits of your production. They don't have, above all, they have no spiritual ideal. We say the only thing that's worth protecting with your life is ideals and your family, your race, and your nation. And twice in my lifetime, I've been called upon to go out and risk getting killed. And I saw a lot of other young men doing this. Young fanatics that they made out of us, by the way. They made us real fanatic haters of the Germans and fanatic haters of the Japanese. Nobody protested that that was bad to be a fanatic when we were fighting those Japs, and I assure you we all were. Finally, the communists, if you remember when they first got into Russia, they are against morals. They had free love, no morals at all, everything was have a butt. And the result was they almost tore Russia to pieces, they just fell apart. Now, if you'll notice, they are almost puritanical in Russia. In order to make the thing work, they've had to go back to the very principles of tribalism which we're advocating. You can't work society with a communist pipe dream. Civilization is based on self-sacrifice, on the willingness of men to go out and die for what they believe in. When you get rid of that self-sacrifice, you get anarchy. Civilization is built because I am willing to give up something for my family. And the family is willing to give up something in order to have the town succeed. And the town is willing to give up something so the state can be in business. And the state is willing to give up something so the nation can succeed. Self-sacrifice is the first principle of civilization. Communism has got the fanaticism to destroy you, and it's doing it. And unless you can build up a counter-fanaticism for something you believe in positively, you will be destroyed. You are being destroyed.
Recently, there was a report out that among new babies that were born, this happened last year, minorities were now the majority, that whites were officially the minority.
And they're boasting about it. Khrushchev just said, America's so liberal, they'll never fight. And I think there's a lot of truth to that, but we're going to change that. It won't be quite so liberal. After we've had a chance to make America understand what it is and make it conscious of itself and its greatness and its people, and the white race understand that they're worthy of protecting themselves, that they don't have to keep humbling and downgrading themselves while other races are standing up and saying, look at us, how great we are. We keep saying we're ashamed of ourselves for being white. That's a terrible thing. The thing for each race to do is be proud of itself. And the white people and the good people of this country, when they finally realize that they can do that without hurting or being obnoxious to anybody else, they will finally become fanatics to survive, to keep this great country going.